From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Home is the place where the three or four truly important things that happen in a life happen, wrote Auden. Not for author Jeff Dyer, not unless we call all the world our home. In his new book, Yoga for People Who Can't Be Bothered to Do It, the perpetual seeker and un-yoga master goes way off-road in search of what he calls the zone. Tonight on Point and Off-Road, conversation with author Jeff Dyer. But first, congressional reaction to Colin Powell's big UN speech. The Secretary of State appeared before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today, taking the State Department case to Capitol Hill. I spoke earlier with Gail Chadwick, chief congressional reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. I asked her to describe Powell's message to the committee.
Well, he was there to talk about his budget, support for the diplomatic efforts of the U.S. government. But of course, in light of the UN presentation, it's impossible to avoid the topics that most of the senators wanted to talk about, which was Iraq, North Korea, the Middle East, and other hotspots around the world.
Did you get a sense, Gail Shattuck, of how the senators, and I guess more broadly on Capitol Hill, how Congress received Colin Powell's presentation at the UN?
With immense respect, I'd say he's probably the most revered person on Capitol Hill right now. He's treated like no other political figure. It's a very partisan and charged atmosphere on Capitol Hill, but you wouldn't know it when Colin Powell is speaking. Nonetheless, Democrats and some Republicans managed to raise some very important quiet points in this atmosphere of respect, especially as to whether or not war with Iraq was going to preclude the resources, diplomatic and otherwise, needed for other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a sense that Congress is lined up now behind the Bush administration if and when they want to go to hot war with Iraq?
Well, the sorry fact is that Congress is nearly irrelevant at this point. The resolution that they voted last year gives the president the authority he needs to go forward. Now, many of his advisors, especially in the Republican Party, are saying he would be wise to continue discussions with Congress to keep up support, even as he would be wise to get as much of the world community behind him as he wants to. But there is, to my mind, a great sense of demoralization among Democrats that they couldn't stop this president if they wanted to, and they're not united enough to do it.
Was there a questioning at all of the evidence that was presented before the Security Council yesterday?
No. No. By and large, the evidence that there's no one that I've heard that's willing to come out and say, you know, we don't think the evidence was strong enough. You know, Nancy Pelosi, I just left a briefing. She's the new Democratic leader in the House. Mm-hmm. In effect said, we'll posit the evidence. Our points are going to be made beyond that. Let's assume that Saddam Hussein is up to no good and he's hiding everything and he has a serious program underway. What is it going to take to mobilize more of the world community behind an effort there? Everyone agrees that we could probably defeat Saddam Hussein very quickly, but what about the cleanup afterwards that's likely to take years, tens of thousands of troops? Does the United States have the resources alone to do that?
From what I've seen,
Gail, need the rest of the world.
From what I've seen, Gail Chadwick, Colin Powell is actually embracing that onward task this morning, describing it as a kind of great opportunity to remake the Middle East in a democratic mold.
Well, he's embracing it, but if you listen very closely to what Senator Lugar, for example, is saying, it's an opportunity, but it's also an immense cost. And both Senators Biden and Lugar agree on this point. They'll be having very important hearings next week on this, pressing the administration to be very clear with the American public about what kind of commitment they're calling for. It could be years. It could even be decades of U.S. troops in a very hostile region.
Does it mean sacrifices of other goals on Capitol Hill? Are congressmen looking at it in that way, Gail Shattuck?
Yes, they are, also on both sides of the aisle. Listen closely to people like Senators Chafee, Senator Hagel, both Republicans, pressing on what's happening to the peace process in Israel. What about Prime Minister Sharon's comments that he isn't going to pursue the roadmap that the U.S. is laying out.
To an independent Palestinian state.
Exactly. What does that mean? Are we really holding his feet to the fire? Is there progress being made on that front? Now, there's a lot of concern about that on both sides of the aisle.
And behind the political bandwagon, do senators, congressmen really support the move to war, or do they feel they must support it in the public eye?
You know, that's a very good question. I had an off-the-record talk with a senator today on that point who was just in despair on that issue. He or she, I don't want to say which, said, you know, if we get emotional about this, they'll just say we're not really fit for our job, we don't have a corporate mindset, we can't deal with these issues in a mature way, but we don't know what to do at this point. That's why I think that demoralization is not an inappropriate term for what's going on among those on Capitol Hill who have real questions but don't see a way to pursue them.
But for this day, Colin Powell as conquering hero even before the war begins.
That he is.
Gail Chadwick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Gail Chadwick is congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. The 21st century life is fast, it's furious. We crowd our 24-hour days, and every one of those hours is drawn to fit into the big picture, that insistent media-made framework of meaning, headlines, events. But the heart of life doesn't fit inside a package. Human experiences, the kind that count and last, often come slowly and with crazy loose ends. They ramble and veer at odd angles from the forced march of history. Author Jeff Dyer knows about life's odd angles. He's written about trying to write about D.H. Lawrence and never quite getting there in Out of Sheer Rage, and about slacking off with style in Paris Trance. In his new book, Yoga for People Who Can't Be Bothered to Do It, Dyer jumps out of the media jet stream and into the grand, odd corners of the world with a restless mind and pen. From the green back roads of Bali to the dark fringes of New Orleans to the dried-out, drugged-out Nevada desert, Dyer offers no yoga, but a barrel full of hilarious, humble, moving observation of the perverse and marvelous human grain of life. We're delighted to have him with us. Jeff Dyer, good evening. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, very nice to be here.
It's good to have you. You who writes about yoga for people who can't be bothered to do it, and authors who can't be bothered to really write about yoga in books so titled.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Read us a little bit from a moment in Bali, in Ubud, of course, the artist colony, which is now colonized by tourists, where you are with a lovely traveling companion and thinking about our whole notion of the view.
Okay, here we are in Bali, myself and my companion called Circle, and we're walking through and talking about rice paddies. The view, strictly speaking, is the product of a separation of leisure and labor, I said. I had no idea if what I was saying was accurate. I was making it up as I went along, but I carried on regardless. Not surprisingly, then, this view is improved by, in fact, almost demands the sight of people toiling in its midst, actively engaged in its creation and preservation. It's like that bit in Jean de Florette or Manon des Sources where Gérard Depardieu asks a peasant if he likes the view, and the peasant just doesn't know what he's talking about. You have to be a stranger to the landscape to regard it as a view. This idea of the view, or prospect, was once the preserve of a small ruling elite. Then it became a bourgeois right. Now that travel has been democratized, the view is available for everyone, except the people who are employed to maintain it. In keeping with this, said Circle, the place from which you are enjoying the view often blights the view of the people whom you are viewing. We sat back and enjoyed the view, in a manner of speaking. It would be more accurate to say what I said to Circle after a few minutes of sitting and looking. I see the view, I said. I view the view, but I can't participate in the act of seeing it. Oh, that's the covenant of the rice paddy, said Circle. Separation is the price you pay for not having to work in them. I feel it in other kinds of landscape too, I said, at the vista points of the Grand Canyon, for example. Perhaps the separation is more fundamental, said Circle, the alienation of urban man, or you at any rate, from the natural world. It's only when I'm stoned, I said, that I feel a part of the landscape. When I can see the landscape as a bird or tree might see it, then I can enjoy the view. And it is, of course, at that exact moment that the view is no longer a view.
Jeff Dyer, reading from his new book, Yoga, for People Who Can't Be Bothered to Do It. You've taken this sensibility all over the world: New Orleans, Cambodia, Indonesia, Rome, Miami, Amsterdam, Libya, Detroit, a very depressing interlude there, Black Rock City in the Nevada desert where Burning Man goes on. I hope that you'll just be good enough to tell us some stories tonight, Jeff, whether they're straight from the book or not. You open the book in New Orleans, and you run into quite a character there, Don Lee.
Yeah.
Who was this guy?
Well, I moved to New Orleans, to the French Quarter, on a whim, really. I was going there to write a book, and I was having a fantastic time, except I was so incredibly lonely. And then in this weird way, another lost soul moved into exactly the same apartment block that I was living in. And he was this incredible character who was recovering from his suicide attempt, which came in the wake of his having been diagnosed with skin cancer, from which there was a good chance that he was going to die. I mean, he recovered from it, and just in the way of things, we became great, great friends, these two people who'd ended up in New Orleans in a completely random way. And actually meeting him completely transformed my experience of being friendless in New Orleans. And the story really is partly a narrative of what we were doing, but it's also a wave or a hello to him, because this was in the days before email. I've completely lost touch with him. No idea what became of him after this weird interlude when our paths crossed for a little while.
How many bullets do you think he has in his gun these days?
Well, that's the thing. In the book, there's this great moment when I, for the first time ever, see a gun. Donnelly has a gun in the glove compartment of his car, and he shows me this gun.
You being British, not familiar with
not
guns
familiar
lying
with
around
the way
in
of
glove,
the gun.
Glove boxes, glove
yeah.
compartments.
And he was really distraught because he only had three bullets left. And so we had this kind of mad conversation about the need for him to go to, well, I didn't even know what it was called. I presumed it was called a bullet shop, but to buy more bullets. But, yeah, it certainly had a great impact on my young mind, this bullet conversation.
Did you know as you were writing this that you were setting out to write this book? Is this notebooks emptied out years later, notebooks desperately turned into a book when you were afraid they were not, nothing?
It's a bit of both. Sometimes I've been to places like New Orleans with no idea really that what I was experiencing there was going to be written about at all. In other ways, I actually went to places specifically to write about them, and that both ways of proceeding have things going for them. I think if you go to a place to write about it, then right from the start you're in this heightened state of responsiveness. Your antennae are up and you're regarding everything with a real sort of super clarity. On the other hand, quite often you're having these experiences, and it's only after a passage of time, sometimes as much as 5 or 10 years, that you realize that what you experience there, if you employ a certain amount of authorial editing and shaping, can actually have the basis of a story, the nature of which completely eluded you at the time. So the book is made up of a combination of those two things. But bear in mind that I am a writer, so in a sense everything that's happening to me has the potential to end up at some point in a book.
You're careful to say that you're not necessarily dedicated to it all being factual, though it's all presented in that way.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, most of what I write about is only an inch from what really happened in life. But what that means is that all the artifice, all the creativity is happening in that inch. So I think you've got to be really careful when writers are primarily autobiographical. Rather, you've got to be especially careful not to assume that what happens in the book is an accurate reflection of what really went on in the life.
That inch-wide nimbus is nearly always lurking around there somewhere.
Right.
You seem to take all these travels and apply a kind of a Zen treatment to them. It's right there in your title, the kind of Zen cone.
Yes.
Yoga, for people who can't be bothered to do it, you know, the Zen cone idea of things that are and simultaneously are not. Mm. Is this a piece of your inch of artifice?
Well, I think there's a lot of negative Zen going on in me, in that there's the kind of classic idea that we have of the Eastern wisdom, whereby wherever you are at one with yourself. And the kind of thing that I've gone on about in this book at some length is that wherever I am, I'm often dissatisfied with it.
Yes.
And out of that,
you're very plain about that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm floundering in a sea of impulses. And out of that comes a kind of weird kind of negative imprint of contentment. And insofar as the book has any kind of narrative journey, and of course it's not a straightforward narrative and the sequence is not chronological, but it does move towards this ideal of contentment, which, you know, I call in the book the zone. And hopefully The book is a movement towards this idea of being completely in the moment, that is to say, in the zone.
We're talking tonight with author Jeff Dyer. His new book is Yoga for People Who Can't Be Bothered to Do It. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Jeff Dyer, author of the new book, Yoga for People Who Can't Be Bothered to Do It. It's part languid observation, part humor, part travelogue. In this passage, Dyer takes us to the lush green rice paddies of Ubud, Bali. Jeff Dyer.
We'd never seen anything as green as these rice paddies. It was not just the paddies themselves, the surrounding vegetation. Foliage so dense the trees lost track of whose leaves were whose was a rainbow coalition of one colour, green. There was an infinity of greens, rendered all the greener by splashes of red hibiscus and the herons floating past. So white and big it seemed as if sheets hung out to dry had suddenly taken wing. All other colours, even purple and black, were shades of green. Light and shade were degrees of green. Greenness here was less a colour than a colonising impulse. Everything was either already green, like a snake, bright as a blade of grass, sidling across the footpath, or in the process of becoming so. Statues of the Buddha were mossy, furred with green. Stones had become plant, the inanimate had become organic. Annihilating all that's made to a green thought in a green shade? No, even thought had been annihilated. This was an entirely sensual green, one that rendered thought not just impossible, but inconceivable. However green the accompanying vegetation, the brightest green of all was still found in the rice paddy. To become truly itself, the rice had to be surrounded by the deepest, luscious greens, thereby obliging the paddy to achieve that extra degree of greenness of which only it was capable. There could be only one winner. Relatively speaking, only the rice paddy was really green. Only the rice paddy hummed with green. So it was the green we noticed, that and the amazing fertility of everything, how willing and eager everything was just to grow for all it was worth, for the sheer fun of growing. The tree's being consists entirely in growing, said Circle, in the course of one of our walks. I disagree, I said. So do I, actually, said Circle. Waving its leaves in the wind, providing a perch for birds, being something the sky can enclose, being something to be climbed, these are all parts of the tree's being. But something else, too, I think. Being seen, doing its bit for tourism. I looked at Circle. I thought I'd had the last word. Then I realized she'd been keeping something up her sleeve. But I was not expecting that something to be in French. Arbre, she said. Toujours au milieu de tout ce qui l'entoure. Guess who said that, she said. I'm torn between Baudelaire and Johnny Holiday, I said. Oh, very funny. But I'm going to plump for Rilke, I said, pleased to catch the look of crestfallen admiration that passed over her face.
Jeff Dyer, reading from Yoga for People Who Can't Be Bothered to Do It. You carry the poets around with you wherever you go, in that green in Ubud, and in the cracked cement of Detroit, and the tumble-down Art Deco of Miami, which just about drives you around the bend with despair. Rilke, above all, he's the guy who's all find it within, poet go within.
Mm.
But you're doing a travelogue.
Yeah, this is one of the things that I've been quite sort of keen on over the years, to avoid this, I think, artificial separation, let's say, between the stuff you're experiencing at home in books, you know, the life of the mind, and then there's the stuff that you're experiencing for real in life, whereas in fact the two are constantly informing each other, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And what I've been really keen to do is just to show how your experience is constantly being informed by what you've read, what you're reading. And it seems to me that a lot of the stuff that I was encountering on this trip was being informed particularly by Rilke and also by Auden. And I think it's not for nothing that, you know, that Auden is a big presence in this book, because of all the poets from the past, he seems to be one who at the moment is really, you know, there's a real sort of zeitgeisty thing about what's happening in Auden and the kind of wisdom that he was groping towards.
Why him? Why now?
I think this is something that Adam Gopnik was writing about in The New Yorker, actually. I mean, it was immediately after 11th of September. A lot of people were quoting his September 1939 poem. And I think it's this way that Auden is all the time trying to come up with some version of near-universal compassion, which is also completely compatible with all the vagaries and shortcomings of one's own nature. And there's a lovely bit where he comes up with this very modest attempt at the end of the, what's it called, the Sonnets for China or something. Mm-hmm. And he says, now let's just think what it is that we've learnt in, you know, throughout all this long period of history. And he says something like, well, it's better to eat nice food than nasty. It's better to be liked than dreaded. It's better to sleep two to a bed than single. And I love both the wisdom and the modesty of this kind of thing.
You raised so many things all at once here, Jeff Dyer. Your effort to both be seeing and be fully aware of the kind of interior response to everything at the same time. In so much of the book, you're in settings with travelers. How common is that? What's your view of what travelers generally carry with them in terms of a lens on the world?
Yeah, I think it's really unfair that backpackers have got such a bad name for themselves in England particularly. There's a very sort of knee-jerk snootiness about it. Mm-hmm. Because when I was doing a lot of this travelling, I was in the bits in Southeast Asia. I'd not been to Southeast Asia until I was about 40, and it mm-hmm. completely blew my mind. And a lot of the people I was meeting when travelling, they were maybe as young as, you know, 17, 18, 19. Certainly the majority would have been in their early 20s. Then I think about what I was like at that age when I'd had such incredibly limited experience. And it seems to me it was just an incredible thing to be doing. And, of course, you get this thing that travellers trying to save tiny amounts of money, which become even tinier when they're translated back into, you know, into dollars or whatever.
Still, dickering over 3 cents on a meal or a souvenir.
Exactly like that. But I think generally they bring an incredible degree of responsiveness and, to an extent, responsibility to the countries they're visiting. And certainly that's preferable, isn't it, to the mass tourism of these huge tour buses pulling up at these ancient sites.
Yes, it is. Describe the moment up the waterfall outside of Luang Prabang or somewhere. Was it Laos?
Yeah, it's near Luang Prabang,
And here you are on a kind of multi-tier waterfall, and you're a couple of tiers up. Mm. And you're having this marvelous game of catch with Gregor the Israeli, you and your beloved Tevas, which have taken you everywhere. Yeah. And that holy in-the-moment, share that with us.
Yeah, there's two, you've elided two separate things, actually.
Oh, forgive
me. You know, in upmarket resorts in Bali, there's this phenomenon of the overflow pool or the infinite edge pool.
If we haven't seen the pool, we've all seen the ads.
Yeah,
the blue
right.
gives way to the blue of the sea beyond or
exactly.
the sky beyond.
Anyway, and it just occurred to me that that was a man-built, architecturally developed version of the thing of a waterfall, because one of the weird things of a waterfall is that you can nearly always sit right near the lip of the waterfall without tumbling over the edge. There was this absolutely sublime moment where we were at the top of one of these falls with this unbelievable high altitude view of this infinite, incredible, fecund jungle. Then later on, we're back at the in our nice hotel, and we're just playing this lovely game of catch on the edge of the overflow pool. And I think what that is, I mean, what's going on there is when you're travelling, quite often, I mean, this is what everyone, it's not an original point I'm making at all, but it's boring, it's inconvenient, and you're, you know, the classic thing is, what am I doing here? And then what nearly always happens is that you'll get some incredible moment, and it can be an incredibly tiny moment, which is completely all redeeming. And you go through a very simple thing in your head and think, well, were it not for all the effort I've gone through, you know, I would have missed this moment. I wouldn't have seen it. And then you think, what do you want from life? And quite often you think, actually, what I'm living for is moments like this. That is to say, there's this search for peak experiences. And I think a lot of what's going on with the book is to try to find those moments where geographical travel to a place corresponds with a great personal high or an epiphanic moment, to put it like that.
And
for
in this
you.
Instance, that epiphanic moment, that personal high, just an exquisite game of catch with one of the catchers on the edge of the infinite edge of the pool and the ball going back and forth as if on a wire almost.
Yes.
You're so in sync with one another, surrounded by bug bites and boredom and swollen feet and all those things that maybe take something so simple and make it wow.
It's also linked, actually, that particular bit in the book with With some personal shortcoming on my part, in that it's been preceded by this description of these ping-pong games I was having. I love to play ping-pong, and...
Got in a real lather to defeat those Southeast Asians who were your hosts.
And I hadn't realised, of course I should have done, that everywhere you go in Southeast Asia, in Laos particularly, I mean, they're really keen on ping-pong. There are ping-pong tables around in the same way that there are, let's say, basketball, hoops in New York or something. And that particular piece begins with my playing this game of ping-pong, which I'm destined to lose because my desire to win is so great. And, of course, the piece then ends with this kind of zen-like game where we're both on the edge of the overflow pool. And the idea, the game only works, really, if the person you're throwing the ball to is able to catch it. But equally, you don't want to make... It's no fun for him if it's too easy to catch. So there's a lovely kind of cooperative competition that's going on, which is the exact opposite of the kind of self-destructing will to win that I was displaying in the ping-pong
game. In a full sweat over the ping-pong game. Jeff Dyer, I guess one of the elements of that inch of fiction that you're prepared to weave around that just caught me and I enjoyed but also left me wondering was living in the news... as I do in this business day after day, and as many people do now when the events have been so simultaneously disturbing and unifying, but thereby engrossing, the news, great events, is almost entirely absent from this entire book, as though you were living in a bubble so much of the moment, so much of each particular small e event, that the great news was you're oblivious to it. Is that theater?
It happened that there wasn't any news going on. When I was doing this traveling.
So the 90s holiday from history gave you the interlude.
Really. I wonder, quite a lot of the places where this book is set. I sometimes wonder, at what point would news of 9/11 have trickled through to us at some of these places? And I suspect it would be really we'd be surprised by how quickly that news gets to even these quite remote places. And maybe in the wake of that 9/11, one of the saddest things is this, I think, that generally the most paranoid, frightened people you meet are those who've actually travelled least. So that typically there's somebody in London who will say, oh, it's not safe over there, you can't walk down that street. Well, actually, the more you travel in the world, generally you find that people are pretty nice the world over. Now, this isn't to say that there aren't these kind of upheavals when people become possessed of this incredible spirit to go berserk. So, of course, in Kosovo, in Rwanda, I'm not being naive. But generally, I mean, I was in Algeria, for example, not long after the Gulf War ended, and was actually shocked by the incredible hospitality that came my way. And perhaps one of the saddest things about the wake of 9/11 is that maybe, and I don't know whether this is true, I just throw it out as a speculative point, maybe that's not the case anymore because, here were we in Bali where the people, Bali was in the grips of this incredible economic collapse because of political instability.
The whole Indonesian meltdown, late 90s.
Yeah, sure. And then, of course, we see on the news that the Bali bomb happened. So even this place, Bali, which had been so insulated from all the political instability elsewhere in Indonesia, even that was affected. And also, I mean, for me personally watching the news, one of the outrageous things about that, it was treated as though it was an attack on Australia, when, of course, it wasn't. It was an attack, as much as anything, on Bali. Mm-hmm. There was an incredible kind of bias in the coverage of that, as though what happened to the Balinese people didn't matter.
Everything that had blown up in that moment for them.
Yeah, because, of course, they're so dependent on tourism, which had pretty well down to nothing anyway, and I don't know what kind of future they're looking at now.
But you may be right. If the megaphone that the media gives to calamitous events makes them global events very quickly, if that ends up separating us one from the other, one culture from the other, well, then these wonderful small moments that you have here, we never get around to having. The women, they're so appealing. I want to know how much fiction is here. At that moment where Kate is drying off out of the shower and you look up and your nose is inches from her belly and I'm thinking, man, is that sexy or what? You must be a real bed magnet, Jeff Dyer.
Oh, that was a great moment, wasn't it, in the book.
But this is off the coast of Thailand somewhere,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, that's right. There's another great moment in the book, though, and I can find it quite quickly,
sure,
if you don't mind me rustling incredibly. No. Oh, yeah, here you are. This is me in New Orleans. When you are lonely, writing can keep you company. It's also a form of self-compensation, a way of making up for things, as opposed to making things up that did not quite happen. So that's a nice diplomatic way of skirting that point, isn't it?
Oh, your imagination is fantastic. Give us a quick thumbnail on places that we won't be able to really get into in detail with you, but we're glad to have had you visit Libya. Just a sense, you were there. You said that the airport, you described the airports as being a kind of international gauge because they're so uniform generally that all the little slight distinctions leap up and make us see something. Well,
yeah, that's right. In airports, they're on the fringe of non-space, aren't they? And since they are broadly similar the world over, then all the incidental details actually magnify the differences between places. And I went to Libya specifically to go to see the ancient Roman ruins in Leptis Magna. And, oh, I would say it's one of the greatest places on Earth, all the greater for the fact that virtually nobody visits there. Obviously, there's incredible Roman ruins in... Well, there's great Roman ruins in Rome, not surprisingly.
Described in your book.
Yeah, but the ruins at Leptis Magna are completely unvisited. They're absolutely incredible. And maybe it's about sort of 100 kilometres outside of Tripoli, and Tripoli wasn't a place that I was in any great hurry to return to.
Why?
It was just awful, really. It was there was one particular hotel there that I was staying in, and it's this weird thing which you get from time to time. You go to a restaurant, let's say, where the food is so bad and the service is appalling. You wonder, but why has this person got into the restaurant business? What was the motive for this? This is something that we're all complaining about, the way that places get ruined, you know, that people say typically, oh, when I was here 20 years ago, there was nothing here, blah, blah, blah. At the same time, I'd have kind of liked it more if there had been a lovely little boutique hotel that I could have stayed in. And so there's that kind of balance, isn't there? On the one hand, you don't want the places to be completely ruined by this massive growth of hotels. On the other hand, I think people are being disingenuous when they complain about some kind of level of, let's call it, service provision, because it is quite nice to get nice food and all this kind of thing.
There are other places, though. Other places that haven't been innocent for a long time, but that you found fairly desolate. Miami was no favorite of yours.
Oh, actually, in Miami, we did have a great time. We'd been in the Bahamas for about a month before then. The Bahamas, though lovely, was kind of boring, and Miami was so much fun.
But Art Deco, you describe as almost choking you in despair.
Oh, that was just a personal indisposition. But the Art Deco hotels of South Beach, I thought, were really, absolutely, absolutely stunning. And at the same time, in Detroit, I had some troubles there, let's say.
Nervous breakdown, as you describe it, to be more precise.
But yeah, Detroit was really fantastic. And in nearly all of these places, there's some particular thing that goes on that makes me really glad I've ended up there. So that's why the Detroit and the Libya passages, they all end on this kind of lyrical note where... some kind of, what to call it, contentment or at-oneness is achieved.
We're talking tonight with author Jeff Dyer. His new book is Yoga for People Who Can't Be Bothered to Do It. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Seven.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Jeff Dyer, author of the new book, Yoga for People Who Can't Be Bothered to Do It. He takes an unflinching look at ruins in the ancient cities he visits and in his own life. In this passage, Jeff Dyer takes us to the ruins of Leptis Magna on the Libyan coast.
Virginia Woolf apparently told Rupert Brooke that the sky between leaves was the brightest thing in nature. A profoundly parochial remark, in that it only holds true in the leafy context of Charleston or some English shire. The truth is that the sky is brightest around the edge of antique columns, and no line is sharper than the one dividing a column from the sky that frames it. There is a simple, entirely irrational explanation for this. What separates the column from the sky has been worn down, has become thin, and therefore sharp, over time. The sky is as close as can be while still remaining distinct. This absolute separation between the timeless man-made and the eternal is never as pure as it is in the ruins of Greek or Roman antiquity. That's one way of looking at it. The other, a different way of looking at the same thing, is that the distant past is brought into sharp adjacency with the present. The ruins were bathed in a perpetual present, of which the golden light and stalled moon were the perfect expression. I moved from place to place, arranging the intersections of columns, sea, and sky in new ways, new angles. Perhaps the simplest lesson of antiquity is that, after a time, anything vertical, Doric, Ionic, Corinthian, whatever, commands admiration. Ultimately, though, the lure of the horizontal will always prove irresistible. That's why the ancient vertical is always enhanced by a backdrop horizon of sky and sea. From their point of view, the point of view, that is, of sea and sky, Leptis Magna was still in the early stages of a career of ruination which would end, ultimately, as desert, when the horizon would be undisturbed by any vestige of the vertical, the final triumph of space over time.
Jeff Dyer, I love that repeating theme of ruins and the way you capture how people respond to ruins differently. Just last summer, I sat looking out on the Acropolis and the ruin of the Parthenon there and was sitting next to a stranger on a rooftop. We saw it absolutely differently. I was looking at it and thinking, oh, you know, here it is, the clarion call, the birth moment that speaks to everything that would follow, all science, all Western civilization in that geometry. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, oh, no, I think this is the ruin. It's the end of a time of grace and a time of democracy and the great antiquity of Athens. For me, so the beginning for him, it was the end.
And of course, you were both right.
Yes, yes, yes.
You know, people respond very, very strongly to ruins. And, you know, you can think about why this is. And I think one of the things we respond to is, are these places where you feel time has stood its ground? And that becomes especially remarkable now when things are obliterated so quickly. Then what happens, I think, is after a long period of time, these places generate a certain power. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, what you start thinking is, maybe these places had something within them that enabled them to resist the march of time and this kind of thing. So there's a
they're not vanished in any case. They're there.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's what grants them that peculiar kind of attraction, and that's what lures us to them.
What about your own ruin and soldiering on through it? You describe it, frankly, a kind of nervous breakdown in Detroit. There's any number of points in the book. I mean, it's very, very jolly, tons of humor through here. But then also these moments where the ruins are maybe speaking too loudly.
But I would hope the funniest bits of all are the bits of complete ruination.
Oh, they are. Absolutely. You had me practically in tears of laughter at certain points. Were you finding your saving graces in these ruins or onto the next destination?
Well, I had this idea that I wanted to write a book about ruins, and it very quickly became apparent to me that it was going to be appropriate if the author of that book underwent some kind of ruination too. It's just like writing fiction, really, whereby, let's say somebody writes a book about killing somebody. Well, we don't suppose for a moment that the author of the book has actually gone out and killed somebody. But, you know, they maybe have this murderous impulse in them. So at the same way, this kind of impulse to despair or to giving up is written up and elaborated on, partly to give a dramatic or aesthetic resonance.
It also sets us up to go with you with your most dry and irreverent humor, because if you're at that bleak point, well, then we're prepared to believe that you see the world just any way that you like.
Yeah. I mean, that German expression, whatever it is, Schadenfreude or whatever,
yes,
where you find the other's misfortune funny
pleasurable
and uplifting. Yeah. But also there's a kind of more advanced version of that concept whereby you find your own you find your own
yes,
misery,
even your own devastation,
enjoyable, yeah, and in fact take some sort of sucker from that.
Yeah. You open the book with a little quote from Auden, detective story, 1936, where he talks about home, the center where three or four things that happen to a man do happen. And you open and saying, but how can that be? I'd say, you know, I've been invested in travel and in being away from home. And you finally circle back around to that at the Burning Man gathering in the Nevada desert. What's it called? Black Rock City,
Black Rock City,
weekend that it's there.
Yeah.
Share with us what you found in that burning desert that brought you back to Auden's line.
Okay, so Burning Man, which, to be absolutely frank, is the greatest thing that has ever been in recorded history. It's right up there with the Pantheon, the Parthenon, and all the rest of it.
I'll be frank.
So it's a gathering that takes place in the Black Rock Desert, a festival where, crucially, nothing is for sale. Everything there is brought by people as a gift. There's almost no rules. I mean, the one rule would be you can do anything you want as long as nothing you do diminishes anyone else's enjoyment.
And I guess we think of it as a place where geeks and artists flood out of California once a year to sit in the desert.
And it is that too, but not to sit in the desert, actually, because as much as anything else, Black Rock City is a huge construction site, so people are doing lots of, it's, you know, people are working like mad. So this absolutely idyllic place comes into existence for a week.
And a very tall figure of a man stands over the gathering.
Right in the middle of it, yeah. And anyway, one of the lovely things is when you arrive at this, you're in the middle of nowhere, which they always hyphenate now here, you're greeted with the words, welcome home. And increasingly, I think, for people who've been, that's not just a nice sort of rhetoric, it really is true in that what we're all seeking for is, one of the things that we're seeking is some way of life or some place where there's no distinction really between what's best for you and what's best for your neighbor. And one of the lovely things about Burning Man, I think, is you get this thing where your own personal experience is all the time being enhanced by the amount of freedom that you're giving and the amount of freedom that you're benefiting from having from, you know, the people all around you. So there's a lovely immersion of the individual and the collective there.
And nowhere is now here. And at the culmination, of course, the tall figure of the man is Burning Man. Is there a passage you could read from that for us?
Yeah, I'll read a little bit to you, which gives a sense, I hope, of the kind of design of the city, because one of the marvelous things about Burning Man is the way that the ethos of the place, all the ideas behind it, are manifest in the design of the city.
Right there in the Nevada desert.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's hear it.
Exactly right. Black Rock City always takes the form of a giant horseshoe, from 2 till 10 on a topographical clock, with a man the still point around which the hands, had there been any, would turn. With the spatial defined by the temporal like this, you always know exactly where you are. Lamps mark a half-mile-long avenue stretching across the plier from Center Camp, at 6 o'clock, to the man. In the daylight, this avenue of extinguished lamps is both reminiscent of the Via Sacra of the Forum in Rome and suggestive of a future archaeology, the blueprint of a civilization briefly glimpsed. Just before dusk every day, the lamps are lit, with some solemnity, by a small procession of lamplighters. Now, Burning Man is usually associated with the primal abandon of the night of the burn, but this ceremonial lighting of the lamps honours a different kind of flame, the steady, ongoing fire of civilization.
There you have it, the place where Jeff Dyer found Auden's home, away from home. Jeff Dyer, it's been great having you. Great hearing more about your travels. And I guess I want to thank you for this book. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for the laughs. Thanks for Donnelly's bullets. Thanks for Kate's belly. Thanks for that green of Ubud. And keep writing. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
Jeff Dyer's new book is titled Yoga for People Who Can't Be Bothered to Do It. In a moment, remembering the storm of the century. This is On Point. It's been a rough winter across the nation. Detroit endured an almost 2-week stretch of sub-freezing temperatures. Parts of New York and Ohio have seen the mercury dip to 28 degrees below zero. Even Tampa shivered through a record low of 27 degrees last month. But none of it can compare to the winter of 1978. First, in late January, the Midwest was slammed by a storm that dropped 40 inches of snow in some areas. Then, 25 years ago today, New England was pounded by the Great Blizzard of 78. That historic 2-day storm dumped several feet of snow, and its hurricane-strength winds carved snowdrifts as high as rooftops. Huge waves crashed the coast, swallowing up homes. Thousands of stranded drivers abandoned their cars in the middle of the road. One stretch of highway outside Boston held 3,000 empty cars on the road, buried up to their antennas. 99 people died in the storm. In this radio diary, New England survivors share their memories of the storm of the century.
My name is Kevin Rozak, and I live in Hopedale, Massachusetts. February 6th started off like any typical Monday. Went to work. But I guess in the early afternoon, they told us we could go home because a storm was coming. So one of the ladies at work needed to get some groceries. I took her to shopping, then brought her home and got on 128. I know we spent a lot of time on 128, and probably around 9 o'clock or so at night, I finally got on 95, and I thought I was home free then, and that's where I stopped for the next 2 days.
What's going to happen is a tremendous amount of energy in high levels of the atmosphere pouring down to the southeast will really enhance the development of this storm, and that's the one that we expect to come up the coast in a fashion something like that. With all the cold air that...
My name is Linda Barris, and I live in Hull, Mass. We have a 14-foot seawall. Normally, the water comes barely up to the bottom of it. I could see that the water level had risen all the way up to the top of the wall. It became very clear that we had to leave immediately, probably within 5 minutes.
I was taking a few courses, so I had a lot of books in the car. So I was just kind of catching up on my homework. So it was a good time to... no excuses not to get my homework done for that week, that's for sure. So we'll just read the books and, you know, relax and just wait for things to happen. And, you know, and having the radio in the car and knowing that I wasn't the only guy out there made it so much easier to work through it.
Unquestionably, the bulk of this storm has to be in the form of snow. We think it's going to be a big one, one of the biggest of the winter. The only way we can see being wrong is if this storm...
I went back in the house, packed the kids in the car. From what we could see of the road, it appeared just to be a snowy road. Well, when we drove into it, we found it was like 4 feet of water, and we drove right into it. The snow was just sitting on the top, so you couldn't discern it. So we were sitting there stuck, and the next thing we knew, lightning hit a transformer probably 50 feet away from our car. The wires in the transformer fell, and some of the wires were hitting the fence, and the fence started to glow pink, and there were wires jumping all over the place. So we were frightened. We didn't know whether we could get out of the car or not get out of the car at that point, but we also couldn't stay in the car. Water was coming into the car. And probably after about 2 minutes, it all stopped. The fence stopped glowing. The wire stopped jumping. We then figured we could leave the car.
I had made a point every 2 hours to go out of the car and shovel out the tailpipe, you know, so I wouldn't have any kind of trouble with carbon monoxide poisoning. And there were just cars of people all around me. Well, apparently they came by with snowmobiles during the day on Tuesday sometime, and I must have been sleeping or just not paying attention. And then when I went out to shovel off my tailpipe, I could see all the cars were abandoned, and I was the only person out there. That's when I got a little bit concerned, and I saw a snowplow going by in the other direction. I flagged him down.
We started walking, and I went back to get a blanket because the youngest didn't have any mittens on or anything. I went back, got the blanket, and sort of threw it over my shoulders and started walking up the hill a little bit, and a gust of wind came underneath and actually lifted me off the road. And my oldest son came and sort of pulled me down. He said, "Ma, what are you doing up there? Get down." He was like totally freaked by it and pulled me down and put the blanket around the baby instead.
So when I went to Howard Johnson's, it was basically full of all stranded travelers, which was nice. We get to talk to other people, but I just wasn't very comfortable sitting down, so I actually went in the kitchen and did some work and did some dishes and helped prepare some food. I had enough of, I guess, downtime by then, so wanted to do something productive. We were there about, I think, probably about a day or so, and the National Guard actually brought us to a shelter, and we spent one night there. The next morning, they brought us home.
We walked to the very first road that we came to, and we noticed some lights on in the first house going up that street, and we walked up there through about, I'd say, hip-deep snow anyway, and knocked on their door and asked them if they would please let us in. They were strangers at the time, and they were a nice older couple, and they said, "Of course, come in." They took care of us for 2 days.
Special thanks to WBUR's Sean Cole and Boston's Channel 7 WHDH-TV for archival audio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.